This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the spring of 1942, Bill Manbo and his family were taken from their home in Los Angeles and locked up by government authorities. It wasn't anything they did that put them in. It was who they were. The Manbos and thousands of other Japanese-American families were forced into internment camps during World War II. Bill and his wife and two-year-old son were placed in the Heart Mountain Relocation Center in Park County, Wyoming. Heart Mountain was one of 10 internment camps in the United States at the time. These camps and the people imprisoned in them are something of a blur in our national memory. However, the pictures developed by Bill Manbo and his camera make it a little harder to forget. Some of the photos have been published in a new book, Colors of Confinement, Rare Kodachrome Photographs of Japanese-American Incarceration in World War II. The photographs capture a complex picture of life in the Heart Mountain internment camp. Eric Muller edited the book. He's a professor at University of North Carolina's Chapel Hill School of Law. He's also the author of the book American Inquisition, The Hunt for Japanese-American Disloyalty in World War II. And he joins us today in the studio. Welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be back.
Give us an idea, first of all, a picture of Japanese internment. We actually have to be reminded about what happened in World War II.
Well, we do. I mean, certainly here in the Southeast, it's not a basic part of the curriculum, and it's not really in high schools. It's not really part of the story. And so this episode has largely receded in memory, and we do need to be reminded that for a period of several years in the 1940s, while other countries around the globe were rounding up people and placing them behind barbed wire, this country was doing that as well. Now, we were doing it differently. Of course, we were doing it differently, very differently from how the Nazis were doing it. But this was certainly one of the largest scale civil rights violations in the nation's history. And it's 70 years ago now that people moved into these camps. So I think it's appropriate for us to be thinking about it again.
And just to be clear, we're talking about United States citizens. We're not talking about Japanese aliens who might be here on some kind of visa.
Well, we're talking about both. We're talking primarily about American citizens. So Japanese people began coming to the United States in the late 19th century. American law at that time did not allow people who were Asian to naturalize as citizens. So Japanese immigrants remained aliens in this country by law. And then in 1924, immigration from Japan was cut off completely. But those immigrants stayed in the United States and they had children. And their children born in the United States were American citizens because the 14th Amendment says so. And so we're talking by the time 1941 rolls around and the attack on Pearl Harbor, you're talking about around 120,000 people along the West Coast. The overwhelming percentage of the Japanese and Japanese-American population was along the West Coast of the United States, rounded up in the spring of 1942. And regardless of whether they were aliens or citizens, regardless of whether they were 1 year old or 99 years old, men or women made no difference. All of them, simply because they were of Japanese ancestry, were rounded up and placed behind barbed wire.
And of course, the same thing was not happening to Germans and Italians in this country, or people of German and Italian ancestry,
well,
if they were citizens.
That's correct. There was no program that the government operated that targeted American citizens of German ancestry or Italian ancestry. None. There were very narrowly targeted programs of detaining enemy aliens, and there were some German enemy aliens and Italian enemy aliens who were rounded up after Pearl Harbor, but that was a very different program, and the crucial point is that it didn't cross that boundary between alien and citizen.
And, of course, we expect that this was unconstitutional, and obviously it would point to a certain amount of racism in American policy when it comes to rounding up Japanese.
Yes, there's little question that the basic distinction between an 18-year-old person living in San Francisco whose last name was, Hoshizaki, and one living in San Francisco whose last name was, Corelli or Stacio or Schmidt.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between those three young guys is that one of them was of Japanese parents and the other were not. And so it was the Japanese American who was shipped off, not the Italian or German American.
So let's tell us about Bill Manbo and his photographs and his camera that he took inside this
right.
Camp.
So this is a collection of photographs, about 180 of them total, about of which 65 are in this book. What's really striking about these photographs, first and foremost, is that they're in color. I would wager that most of your listeners, if they were to think, try to capture in their minds an image of World War II, they'd probably land on an image in black and white. They might picture the famous, you know, the sailor kissing the nurse in Times Square, or maybe a ship aflame in Pearl Harbor. Or, you know, it's all black and white. It turns out that actually Kodachrome came into public use in the late 1930s, and Bill Manbo from Hollywood, California, who was sent to Heart Mountain with his family, was a hobby photographer, and I guess just a bit ahead of his time because he was shooting Kodachrome. And so these photographs are the largest, certainly the largest collection of color photographs of life behind barbed wire.
And for those of you who have never touched film in your life and don't know what we're talking about, the virtue of Kodachrome was not only that it was color, but that it was long-lasting. It wouldn't turn sepia on you overnight.
That's right. He was shooting slides, and the slides got boxed up and put in a closet, and they sat in a closet more or less for 60, 70 years. And so, yes, as you say, the genius of Kodachrome is its longevity. And so there's the color in these photographs. In the book is virtually unretouched from the way the actual slides appear.
And they're amazing photos, and they're family photos. I mean, if you didn't know that we're in an internment camp and your freedom is restricted, there's a lot of family life and a lot of diversities, celebrations, ceremonies, as well as just kind of ordinary activities.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that has surprised some people when they've read this book or learned about this book is the idea that Japanese Americans would have been allowed to be shooting pictures in these camps at all. Because back in the spring of 42, just like shortwave radios and knives and guns, cameras were contraband. And so Japanese Americans had to surrender them. But the agency that ran these camps figured out within relatively short order that, first of all, the Japanese Americans posed nothing like the risk that the military had depicted them as. But more importantly, that it would be very basic to establishing some sense of normalcy of life to allow Japanese Americans to reclaim their cameras and begin using them the way you probably use your camera, the way I use your camera, and many of your listeners probably do, which is just taking pictures of your family, taking pictures of your kids, taking pictures of parades, rainbows, sporting events. And that's what Bill Manbo principally did. We might have the chance to talk about a few images that break from that. But as you say, a lot of these pictures are pictures of joyful scenes, parades, dances, pickup baseball games, sumo wrestling matches.
Well, tell us about, let's start with the cover, shall we? Tell us about this photograph.
Yeah, so
the
image on the cover is a picture of six Japanese-American women, young women. These would have been American citizens, standing in the middle of a big field with a tar paper barrack and a chimney behind them. So there's no mistaking where they are. They are in an internment camp. But what's really striking about them, A, is that the image is in color, but more importantly, they're all wearing kimonos and very, very dressed up. And you would think in a lot of ways like you might be looking at a picture of something happening in Japan. So it's this stunningly beautiful image, very, very colorful clothing. And the women are having a good time. They are laughing about – somebody has just said something in this picture that's very funny. And so the women are laughing. They look – it's a very unexpected image of this time period, both because it's in color, because you see evidence of Japanese rather than just American culture, and because it's a picture of a happy moment, not a moment of at least on its surface,
right,
not a moment of great suffering.
Well, there are a lot of those in this book, and of course it does convey a kind of normalcy within that abnormal and highly illegal situation. And so it contrasts, that photograph on the front contrasts starkly with the one on the back. And maybe you can tell us about that.
The one on the back is a photograph taken of the photographer's little son, who in the picture would have been about 3 or 4 years old. And he is facing the photographer, and he's clinging to a barbed wire fence that rings the camp. And then behind him, in the camp's interior, stretching all the way to the horizon, very bleakly, is a row of tar paper barracks, dozens and dozens of them. So it's a portrait of that the Bill Manbo, the photographer, made of his son, but he obviously chose to position his son in a place where few of us would shoot a photo of our kids clinging to a barbed wire fence.
But if I were to say, give me a picture of an internment camp, this is the one I expect.
Exactly. And Frank, you know, the other scholars who contributed essays to the book and I had to talk for some period of time about what image should go on the cover of this book. The obvious choice would have been the picture that ended up on the back, which is the picture of the little boy clutching the barbed wire, because that's the picture that really captures the basic narrative that the scholarship of this period has tried to emphasize, with good reason. We decided ultimately that what was really new about these photographs was the picture that ended up on the front, the picture of that depicts, rather than so overtly depicting the suffering and injustice endured by the community, that instead depicts the diversity of the community, the resilience, and I think that I want to emphasize the word, the resilience of the community, the cultural and emotional resilience of the community, that in these conditions, these bleak conditions of confinement, they nonetheless managed to sustain periods of joy, cultural and religious practices, some sense of a Japanese identity that they felt did not conflict with their essential Americanness. So we ended up with the pretty picture of the kimonos on the front instead of the bleak picture of the barbed wire.
Well, it's almost amazing if you think about it. If you're in this internment camp because you've been declared disloyal or potentially a threat, and you overtly dress as Japanese, it suggests some sense of being able to maintain your own identity.
It does. What's interesting, though, of course, is that the Japanese-American community for the last 60 or 70 years, having been so deeply traumatized and stigmatized by this false accusation of disloyalty, I think has been very nervous or very reluctant to engage and acknowledge the continuity of Japanese cultural identity during this time period. There's been a desire to depict every 19-year-old as, you know, wearing bobby socks and saddle shoes and jitterbugging to the Glenn Miller band, drinking Coca-Colas and eating hamburgers. And that is there was a lot of that. Right. That was a major part of their identity. But, you know, I'm the son of an immigrant from another country, and many of our listeners probably are children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren. We understand how the parents or the grandparents' culture continues to infuse our lives. That's something we celebrate about American culture and Americanism. And that's exactly what was happening in these camps as well. So I think it's one of the wonderful things I think about these photographs is that they really help us see that these people were not living black and white lives, and they were also not living lives of cartoon characters. They were real people with real stories. Complicated stories
having to navigate a couple of cultures. So then there's these photographs of kids, I think mostly, dressed in scout uniforms.
Right. Boy and girl scouting was one of the most popular activities at Heart Mountain and all of the other nine camps for Japanese Americans. So we have photographs that Bill Manbo took of a scout parade. You've got a young man wearing the scouting hat, carrying an American flag. Behind him is a drum majorette who looks just like she walked out of the Chapel Hill High School marching band, twirling a baton. And then behind them is the Boy Scout Drum and Bugle Corps. So you have this overt, it's hard to imagine. I mean, I suppose if they had all been eating slices of apple pie, that might have made it look a little bit more patriotic. But it's about as patriotic an American depiction as you can get. And yet, look where it's happening.
Right.
The backdrop are these tar paper barracks where they've all been moved because of nothing more than the fact that their parents were from Japan.
And what's also striking about this photo, particularly this one, is that people are watching this parade. So clearly an older generation of, say, grandparents. And I'm thinking, what are they making of this? My kids carrying the flag, dressed in these uniforms, being called disloyal. We're stuck in the camp, and we're marching to this band.
Absolutely. And then, of course, there's another picture in there that we might mention, which is it's almost like conceptually the mirror image of that picture, which is a shot of sumo wrestlers. And it's a wonderful picture because you've got a young man, an American citizen, who at the moment the picture was taken has obviously just succeeded in shoving out of the sumo ring his adversary, who's a much older man and probably a Japanese immigrant. And they're both laughing. They've got these huge smiles on their face, and there's an enormous crowd of mostly men of all generations watching in the background, laughing. It's a very light moment, but again, it's sort of, you know, you've got these generational layers, and you've got the American citizens and the Japanese resident aliens, and you've got them engaging in Japanese cultural activities in an American prison camp. So the layers are just are almost dizzying when you allow yourself to think about it.
Of course, and almost and what's remarkable too is that these photographs capture them. All the other photos we have really are government photos.
That's
camps, and they're mostly in black and white.
And that's another really important point, Frank. There are this is not the only photographic evidence of this period, but most of the evidence that we have was from photographers who were professionals, who were hired by the government to come in and shoot images in these camps. And you can imagine that the War Relocation Authority was interested in projecting an essentially positive image. And you can understand how the incarcerated community might have felt a little bit apprehensive about being photographed by government photographers. Here, it's very evident from these photographs that all of the subjects of the photos are very comfortable being photographed because they're being shot by Bill Manbo, the guy who lives, you know, three barracks down over in Block 16 or, you know, whatever it might have been. So
also a photo of some women and a child, a young boy appears to be, at a river. Was this an outing?
Well, yes, this would have been an outing, although it's probably one that would have been a little bit surreptitious. That's the Shoshone River. The river runs a couple of miles from the camp, and it was technically outside the outer fence boundary. But after between 6 months and a year, the government, realizing how unthreatening this imprisoned community was, significantly relaxed the rules on and the surveillance of the boundary fences. And so it was not uncommon for families to grab a picnic and wander through a culvert over to the Shoshone River and do some fishing. Do a little hiking. So what you've got in that photograph is the photographer's family. One of the women in the picture is his wife, and the little child, I believe that the little child in the water is his son. Obviously off for an afternoon's a break at the Shoshone River.
Really rare insights into that moment in our history. Well, how did you and Bill Manbo get together? How did you find out about the photos?
Well, for a number of years now, I've been working with an organization called the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation, which has built. In fact, last year, last August, we opened a museum at the site of this camp. And I was heading up the committee that was basically designing the museum, the exhibits for the museum. We were working very closely with former internees, one of whom had spent decades gathering memorabilia and photographs. And so he was on our committee. He sent me a DVD with a whole bunch of photographs that he had collected. Most of them, of course, were black and white, which is what I was accustomed to seeing. And I was just sitting in my kitchen clicking through this DVD that he had sent me, and all of a sudden my eyes fell on this color photograph. It's the one that's on the cover of the book, actually. And I just, you know, sort of did that cartoon triple take. You know, I didn't know that there was color photography. I had never seen women in kimonos. And so it was in doing that work for the museum that I learned that this cache of photographs was out there. And then I reached out to the son, who's still alive, the son of the photographer. He's the little boy who's pictured in these photos, and established a relationship with him and eventually got his permission to bring his father's work to public attention.
So how does he feel about it now that it's in print?
Well, Bill is a little Bill, so he's not so little anymore. Right. He's 72 or so now, but he's a man of few words. He's a reticent fellow. But it's very, very clear that he's extremely gratified that his father's work is finally getting viewed by the public and appreciated by the public.
Eric, thanks so much for being with us.
I'm very happy to do it.
Eric Muller, a professor at UNC Chapel Hill School of Law. He is the editor of the book Colors of Confinement, Rare Kodachrome Photographs of Japanese-American Incarceration in World War II. 18 photos from Bill Manbo's collection are on display at the Friday Center in Chapel Hill from now until mid-December. Just ahead, jazz musician Kate McGarry joins us in the studio. Stay tuned.